This is the Education Gadfly Show.
I just realized this is the first fall of my entire life that I am not going back to school.
Teaching or going, right?
Dara, you have entered adulthood.
Okay. It's about time.
Now, here's your host, Mike Petrilli.
Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute here at the Education Gadfly Show and online at edexcellence.net. And now, please join me in welcoming my co-host, the Clint Eastwood of Education Policy, Dara Z. Handler. Did I say that right?
You did. Just say all the letters.
So Dara, I couldn't come up with anything better than that. I didn't want to call you the empty chair of education policy. That wouldn't be fair.
That's okay. Clint Eastwood will have to do for now.
You know, that seemed like such a big deal a week ago, and now it's all but forgotten.
I think now that the Democratic Convention has started, people aren't paying attention.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, now that there's actual real people in those chairs.
Yes.
Exactly.
And plus, some things that are popular on the internet, we know they last for about 30 seconds. So it'll be something else next week.
I would love it. It wouldn't be great if President Obama came out and put an empty chair next to him while he was speaking. And that'd be awesome. And he talked back to Clint Eastwood.
Well, you know, it's an interesting news week when the other big news out of the White House this week is that they released their super secret recipe for their White House beer.
Oh, wow. I would like to check that out. Interesting. Good. We could drink it on our rooftop while watching the White House, because that's the kind of inside the Beltway insiders that we are, Dara. So, Dara, you've been here at Fordham now for about 2 months,
give or take.
Excellent. Coming here from sunny California. So what do you think? Do you feel like a Washingtonian again? This is a return for you.
It is. I was a teacher in Washington, D.C. public schools, and then made the questionable decision to go get a PhD and came back to Washington, D.C., where I feel definitely more like an insider, and also that I have to dress a lot more nicely for work.
Ah, yes. You know, by the way, Rick, do you hear that, Rick Hess? Dress nicely for work, Rick. All right. Okay, dear, lots to talk about today. It is back to school time. Things are humming. Let's play Pardon the Gadfly. Ty, get us started.
Yesterday, Fordham released a study finding that the public would save $10 billion if special education staffing was reduced to the national median. What are the odds such changes are made?
Zero. And you want to know why? Two words, Arne Duncan. Now, look, I like Arne Duncan on many issues, but I am disappointed that earlier this year he flip-flopped on this issue around maintenance of effort. This is a federal requirement that basically says states and districts, you cannot spend less this year on special ed than you spent last year, which is crazy in a time of budget downturns. He was going to allow a lot more flexibility on that and some waivers, and under pressure from the special ed lobby, he changed his mind. What that means is this report finds all these inefficiencies in special ed, and it's driven by having much higher staffing ratios in some school districts than others, and yet really it's not clear the districts could do much about it even if they wanted to.
I think you're absolutely right about saying zero, and in a lot of cases districts are facing some fundamental systemic problems that they simply cannot get around, and Duncan's mandate is one of them. Things like staffing ratios, but when you only have a certain number of special education students in a certain grade level or a certain school, and you have declining enrollment because parents are taking their children elsewhere, you're going to have staffing ratios that are too high. And unless you do something to fundamentally alter this way we educate special education students, sometimes you're going to have too many teachers because there simply aren't enough students.
You know, in most lines of work, when that happens, though, you let people go.
You do. Or you maybe consolidate your production if we're talking about a factory. But in a lot of districts, they can't do that. We're cutting transportation funds. We're cutting budgets for things like operations. How are you going to consolidate your operations when you're talking about special education students?
So, you know, one thing that's interesting from this report by Nate Levinson, a former superintendent, is what he shows is that, you know, it comes around special ed teachers, also paraprofessionals, also even things like speech therapists, that some districts, for whatever reason, just have a culture of having much higher staffing ratios than others. And take the speech therapy thing. To me, this seems kind of like the debate we had a couple years ago in healthcare around these findings that said, hey, if you have a lot of expensive machines, you know, if you have a lot of MRIs in a given city, you will have a lot more referrals to use MRIs, and that drives up the cost. It seems similar. If you have a lot of speech therapists on staff, for example, those districts just make a lot more speech therapy referrals than similar districts. And a lot of those may not be necessary.
I absolutely agree. And I don't know what we can do about the perception, not necessarily perception, but decision being made at the school level to keep those staffing ratios so high. But I can tell you from personal experience, as a high school math teacher, I saw 120 students a day. The special education teacher across the hall from me, who made three times my salary, saw between 10 and 15 students a day. Right. And whether her caseload was low because the principal made it that way, or whether we didn't have the students in our 800 student high school, mm-hmm. I don't know, right. But I do know that I saw many, many more students than she did.
But one last point. Another popular thing that's happened in recent years is people have liked the idea of team teaching. So you're teaching your math class, then you'll send the special ed teacher into your classroom to co-teach, and there'll be a handful of special ed kids that she would help. Suddenly, you have doubled the cost of teaching that class, astronomically expensive, and yet this is sort of caught on as a popular thing to do. Again, we have got to get to the point where we pay attention to effectiveness and cost effectiveness. And we hope this report will encourage people to do that. Of course, then they can't do much about it, thanks to the federal government. Ty, topic number two.
The Democrats released their party platform this week. Now that both parties have outlined their views, just how far apart are they on education?
Darren?
Well, one fundamental thing that I noticed both from reading the platforms and from the rhetoric surrounding these conventions is the difference between the emphasis on closing the achievement gap versus providing education for all students to reach their full potential. Hmm. And these, you know, the former being the Democrat position and the latter being the Republican. And all of their policies stemmed from these two ideas. Hmm. So whether or not they both believe in stringent evaluations for teachers or tenure based on teacher quality, not necessarily seniority, or all of those things, it really all ties down to this fundamental difference of quality education for all students, rich, poor, rural, urban, versus closing the achievement gap.
That's interesting. That's an interesting point. And it could be that that some of the things that, say, Rick has written about achievement gap mania has had an impact on the Republican side. You know, if you look at the platforms, it appears that the parties are quite far apart, certainly on spending. And I think that is real, that they really are far apart on federal education spending. But you know, on the other issues too, around reauthorization and the federal role, I don't know that that reflects reality so much. I mean, I've always thought the Romney education plan that's out there that is now reflected in the platform, you know, I don't take it as too much of a real guidepost to where they're going to head. They needed to come out with something that was distinct from Obama. The challenge here is that, you know, for Romney is, frankly, he agrees with Obama on a lot of these things. And I think in reality, we're not going to see huge shifts if Mitt Romney gets elected president on federal policy. There'll be some shifts. I think it'll be a little more sort of sensitivity to states' rights. And there'll be differences on spending. And I think that's why the big focus in the next couple months when it comes to education is going to be back this traditional debate about how much the federal government should invest in education. I think we're going to hear a lot about that. And that is fair because that is the real difference.
I think I definitely agree with you, especially highlighting the spending differences in higher education, which I realize is not our focus, but that was a big concrete thing that the two platforms really differed on, is the Democrats touting the fact that they've doubled the Pell Grants and they've upped these federal funds for education, and the Republicans saying we want to be completely out of the business of giving these loans. So I think that is definitely a big difference. But I agree that I think both sides really want the same type of reforms, the same spirit of reforms, and really where they differ on that end is who should be in charge, the federal government or the states.
Well said. Topic number three.
Speaking of achievement gaps, Virginia recently caught flack for setting different achievement goals for students by race as part of fulfilling its Race to the Top requirements. Is the state right to rewrite its goals, or should it have stood its ground?
So a couple things here, Dara. First of all, Virginia is not alone. The U.S. Department of Education, Arne Duncan, allowed several states to do this. In fact, this was proposed by Education Trust of all groups when they said that states should be allowed to propose having slicing their achievement gaps in half over the next 5 years. Well, what that ends up meaning is that the end targets are not going to be the same for all racial groups. They're actually, because in general, the African-American, Latino, and low-income kids are way behind. And so even if they make huge progress, they're not necessarily going to catch up all the way with the white and Asian students. That's what happened in Virginia. They caught a lot of flack for not saying, hey, we're going to get 90% of all subgroups to proficiency within 5 years, which I think is unfair. I mean, you know, they're just, you know, nobody thinks that those achievement gaps are going to evaporate in 5 years. What's going on here, Dara?
I think part of it is a reluctance to say that one racial group needs more help than another, not based on the facts, but just based on what it implies. Mm-hmm. Knowing that there's sort of a reluctance to say that, again, falling back on as a teacher, I think that there really is a difference in educating students that come from different communities, regardless of what type of what race they are, and whether that's urban or rural, whether they come from communities where education is valued and parents are involved versus communities where parents are more dealing with economic concerns, things like that. Does that break down along racial lines? Yes, but it is not tangentially related to race. So I would hate that saying we can't make standards based on anything having to do with race. I would hate for that to mask the fact that we need to be focusing on educating students differently because they have different needs.
Very interesting. And now, you know, I think the issue is we're right on the line here where people will say, this is the soft bigotry of low expectations, right? This is you are having lower expectations for minority kids. That's what the NAACP was arguing in Virginia. But again, I think the way out of this, and here Arne Duncan has it right, is to say that if you're going to focus on making progress over time on these proficiency rates, the groups who are way behind need to make significant progress. Mm-hmm. The other groups should make progress too, but they don't have to make as much so that the gap narrows over time. And so, you know, you take the African-American kids from, say, a 40% passing rate to a 60% passing rate, that would be a huge accomplishment. No, you're not getting to 100. You're not getting to as high as the whites, but you're getting a lot closer. That makes sense. You know, have people out there like Andy Rotherham and others demagogue this issue and say, oh, well, you know, we need common targets or else there's lower expectations. I think that just recreates the same problem we've had for 12 years, No Child Left Behind, which is that it does not have credibility because the targets and the goals are so far out ahead. They're so far out in terms of a stretch goal that people look at them and say, all right, you're just out to get me. You're just out to make my school look bad. I can't possibly get to where you're asking me to go to. And then what's the point?
And I think you lose one of the shining stars of No Child Left Behind, if we were to say, you know, pick out some of the good things, is that it does acknowledge that different groups have different needs and that we need to be paying attention to the needs of all of them.
And they're starting from different points.
Mm-hmm.
All right. That's the time we've got for Pardon the Gadfly. Thanks for playing, Dara. Well done. Thank you, Ty. Now it's time for everybody's favorite, Amber's Research Minute. Amber, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Mike.
So, Amber, you used to be a teacher just like Dara. Is this a strange back to school time, not going back to school? Do you miss it?
Oh, gosh, I've been out of it for enough time now to not miss it. I do miss the summer breaks, though. Who doesn't miss that part?
Mm-hmm. Dara, what about you? You miss it?
I just realized this is the first fall of my entire life that I am not going back to school.
Teaching or going, or both.
So I haven't had a chance to let that sink in, but now I'm thinking about
it.
Very strange. Dara, you have entered adulthood.
Okay. It's about time.
About time. Okay, Amber, what you got for us this week?
So the pickings are slim in the research world. Can I just say that? That happens sometimes around here. So we're going to go with a short survey called The Education Insider, published by Whiteboard Advisors. Came out a couple weeks ago.
Wow, we are really at the bottom of the barrel here.
So slim. So listeners, send the research our way. Okay.
This is back to school time. Everybody's supposed to come out with their big studies.
Have you seen any big studies? Because they're not landing in my inbox.
No, no, no offense to Whiteboard. They do a nice job, but this is not a scientific
survey. No, it's not. Hence why my next sentence says, it's far from rigorous, meaning it's not representative, nor do we know exactly who these folks are, nor do we have a response rate, et cetera, et cetera. Anyway, and who knows who these insiders are? Maybe we might even have some around our office. Anyway, here are four key findings from the August report. 35% of education insiders say that the PARC testing consortium is on the wrong track. 73% say the same about SBAC, and they give all these little qualitative comments. Apparently, there's this ongoing notion that SBAC is not sticking closely enough to the standards, which we've been hearing for a while, and that PARC is starting to pick fights and have issues with vendors. Anyway, we can talk more about that. Ample concern from our insiders that neither consortia is serious about cut scores. Second, a third of insiders believe that it will be after January 2015 before ESEA is reauthorized, given the relief provided by the waivers. Some verbally say it's looking like many, many, many years. Third, insiders are evenly split on how the Obama administration has handled education. Majority also report that they think the president will not unveil any new initiatives. I think you were saying this earlier, Mike. If he's reelected, nor will he be tougher on unions than he was in his first term. They think he's just going to kind of treat them the same way. Finally, insiders give both Romney and Obama a B for their work in education. In general, Obama got higher trust marks relative to his handling of several education issues, including charter schools and K-12 accountability.
Well, there you have it.
There you have it.
There you have it. So let's talk just a bit here about 2015 for reauthorizing No Child Left Behind. That is a long time from now, and it's not crazy to say this because we see that Congress is still in total gridlock. And the question is, what's going to change that? And does anybody up there on Capitol Hill care enough to get this thing done? Does it matter anymore? I mean, have we people just stopped paying attention to the law? It's big pieces have been waived. I mean, who cares?
I think so. You have No Child Left Behind, which focuses on outputs. And then you have, well, how do you get a waiver from No Child Left Behind? It's not because you say, well, I'm not going to raise student achievement, but it's because you put into place these ideas for the process in how to get those outputs of high achievement. And I don't think anybody is arguing with any of those things that you need to do to get an NCLB waiver. So I can't see lawmakers in a particular hurry to reauthorize this level for outputs when states are doing things to raise student achievement anyway.
And the money too, you know, I mean, everybody's saying, well, there are no dollars, there's not going to be any dollars to do this stuff, so, you know, why worry and wrestle through it?
See, I think there's a couple strategies here if you really want to push it. I mean, one is if Mitt Romney were elected, he could come in and use the waiver process to say, you know what, states, you have full freedom now to do whatever you want to do. Okay, and that will so piss off the civil rights groups and Ed Trust and others that they will march on to Capitol Hill to try to get a reauthorization done that will rein in that kind of flexibility at the state level. And that could change the dynamic because it's really those groups that have been so effective at keeping reauthorization from moving forward. And that could be a way to kind of spur things from happening. I mean, the only issue left, I think you're right, is the degree to which states have flexibility. And if they decide that they want more or if Romney gives them more through the regulation, I think you could get people back to the negotiating table. But again, what am I? But yet just one insider among many.
How many are? Do you have any idea how many there are?
I don't know. A few dozen, maybe.
A few dozen.
Yes.
Oh, boy.
And,
okay.
I'm pretty sure one of the findings you reported on was my comment in there. So I'm glad that I made it. It's all very circular, Amber.
Funny. Rigorous stuff.
Rigorous stuff. All right.
This doesn't demean my education research minute reputation.
Yes. Ooh. All right. Well, come back with something with a little more rigorous.
Gangbusters next week.
That's all right. Researchers out there, if you got something, send it Amber's way. We don't care if it's published yet. We don't,
That's
know.
That's right.
We'll report on it.
More than 36 people in your insides, we're all about
We're all in that. You can't get... Yeah, our standards are dropping, people. Send it our way. Maybe the election's scaring people off. They think they can't get news in the middle of an election.
Good. We kind of think the same thing.
We got a Washington Post article on our study.
Very true. Very true.
Boom.
Woo-hoo.
Boom. All right, guys. It has been a pleasure, as always, Dara. Thank you for joining us. Your very first appearance on the show. Certainly not your last.
I hope not.
Okay. Until next week.
I'm Dara Z. Handelar.
And I'm Mike Petrilli of the Education Gadfly Show, signing off.
The Education Gadfly Show is a production of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, located in Washington, D.C. For more information, visit us online at edexcellence.net.